ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
50 years ago, on the 11th of November, a political earthquake erupted.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen.
It's the most famous chapter in our political history, and the fallout is still with us today. Hear the whole gripping story of the dismissal, unfolded scene by shocking scene, in our award-winning podcast, The 11th.
He looked at me and said, I owe history nothing.
Search for The 11th on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look, for a while there, Australians got kind of used to serving prime ministers being kicked out of office by their own party. Kevin Rudd, Julia Gillard, Malcolm Turnbull. Before then, it really wasn't the dumb thing, which made the dramatic dismissal of the progressive reformer Prime Minister Gough Whitlam and his Labor government back in 1975 a hugely tumultuous event for the nation, a political and constitutional crisis. This year marks 50 years since that wild moment in political history, half a century. And if you lived through it, I'm probably tickling some neurons today of those memories. If you didn't, on Big Ideas Today, a chance to find out what it all meant and why people still go on about it. So after the then Governor-General John Kerr, the Queen's representative in Australia, dismissed the Prime Minister, he immediately installed the opposition leader, Malcolm Fraser, as caretaker Prime Minister. Imagine that happening today. An election followed, but that extraordinary turn of events still raises a whole lot of questions about the robustness of Australia's democracy to this day. And to consider why, we have Anne Toomey, Professor Emerita of Constitutional Law at the University of Sydney Law School, Frank Bongiorno, who has just been appointed Donald Horne Professor of History and Public Ideas and Director of a new Centre of Public Ideas at the University of Canberra, Barrister Dr Brendan Lim, who is author of the book Australia's Constitution After Whitlam, and asking the questions, I'm delighted to say, is my former ABC Radio National colleague, journalist Paul Barclay, hosting this Constitution Day event at the National Archives of Australia in Canberra.
Frank, we'll be talking a lot tonight about constitutional, legal, political issues, but I thought we'd start. I think it's important to sort of set the scene, to remember the social impact that this moment had, how ordinary Australians responded to the blocking of supply, then the dismissal. There were rallies, strikes. Can you describe some of what happened around this period?
Yeah, I mean, it's really important, Paul, to remember this is a period when, what, probably 60% of Australian workers were in unions. So, you know, immediately supplies blocked in mid-October, you have a strike of 100,000 metal workers. The whole issue of a general strike was a live one in the aftermath of the dismissal on the 11th of November, and Bob Hawke played a key role as president of the ACTU, as well as president of the Labor Party, actually, in essentially directing anger into other channels, you know, like fundraising and all this sort of stuff. But there was still a lot of strike activity. It's an event that was played out on the streets and in the squares, you know, marches on Liberal Party headquarters in Melbourne, broken windows, letter bombs. One went off and injured some workers in the, I think it was the executive building in Brisbane. It was directed at Jobbiocchi Peterson, but there were letter bombs sent elsewhere as well. So, you know, there was a real, I think, a sense of the spectre of civil violence in 1975. And one of the really forgotten dynamics of the dismissal is how many figures, Kerr is one of them, we know from the palace letters, but we also know of other figures within the Liberal Party and beyond it, who feared what would happen in the event of a dismissal of that government, you know, who feared that, you know, social tensions were being, you know, raised to such a level that any government that emerged from it would be regarded as utterly illegitimate, particularly by the union movement, which is overwhelmingly the important social movement of the day because of its sheer numbers and its power in the mid-1970s.
And goes without saying, it polarised the nation, didn't it?
It did. I mean, I guess many of the most enduring images are in this city, aren't they, of the 11th of November. Some of you might have been there, I don't know. And we have, you know, some really vivid images of the protest outside Parliament House, even the ones involving the comedian Gary McDonald as Norman Gunston, you might recall as well. I think he called him Mr. Frazier. But it was, it unleashed great passions. And, you know, remember, Labor boycotted the opening of Parliament. Labor boycotted every public event that involved John Kerr in the aftermath of the dismissal until he departed office at the end of 1977. You know, this was a really passionate business, and people did maintain the rage, as Whitlam had enjoined them to do.
And a number of legal academics at the time were so fired up, they drafted letters of concern about grave breaches of constitutional convention. This was before your days as a legal academic, I hasten to add. What do you remember about this time, if anything?
I do remember it quite vividly, but I was a child in primary school, and I remember being utterly peeved that I only found out about it when I got home from school, but both my siblings had actually heard about it at school. So my sister had been told in class, and this is, you know, again, primary school, and my little brother had been watching Behind the News, BTN on the ABC, which you might all remember, and all the news flashes had come up during that, and so he knew as well. So I felt that I'd missed out. But the other thing that quite struck me at the time was every night on the news you saw, you know, violent scuffles and people throwing eggs at the Governor General's car and such anger, really visceral anger. And I was completely convinced as a child that the election would overwhelmingly result in the Whitlam government winning. And I was really surprised by the election result because it provided another story. It provided, you know, there were a whole lot of people out there who voted in a way that was not the same way as the people who were throwing the eggs and screaming and yelling. And it told me that there was a bigger country. There are the people that you don't see and hear, as well as the ones who are loud. And that was a lesson that I actually learned as a school kid.
Don't worry, Brendan, I'm not going to ask you what you remember of of the dismissal. But you have written a book reinterpreting the Whitlam government and the Constitution. All these years down the track, having delved into that for your book, how do you view the significance of the dismissal, the events leading up to it, and the actions of the key players in it?
My answer to that is intimately tied with the fact that I was not alive at the time of the dismissal. The first Prime Minister I have any meaningful memory of is John Howard. So my
Frank is visibly shocked for the radio listeners.
I'm traumatised.
My interest in the events of the 1970s, therefore, has been necessarily mediated through what are the stories that get retold, that get preserved, as distinct from the ones that get lost or are harder to find. My interest as a constitutional lawyer, when one reads the authoritative constitutional writings about the time, they're very focused on narrow questions. What's the Senate's power to block supply? What's the Governor-General's reserve power to dismiss? And on the question of what's the broader significance or continuing legacy for contemporary constitutional issues, the standard texts in my field would say nothing and treat the events as an aberration, an exception, not something that can cast light on real issues today.
And the dismissal is viewed by most people, I think, as this unprecedented moment in political and constitutional history. Some argue that Whitlam was singled out by conservatives because of his reforms. But you kind of argue that we have a selective memory in this regard, that these events were not unprecedented, that in fact most of the elements of the dismissal had happened before, albeit at a state level. Talk us through some of the examples.
Yeah, so this is the thing, the more you learn about constitutional history, the more you realise the 1975 dismissal wasn't as shocking and surprising as people think. It's just that we have very selective memories. There were some examples, particularly in Victoria in the past, because Victoria had three parties that were often competing and stabbing each other in the back, so there was a lot of instability there. And you did have experience where you know, Labor governments would block supply in the upper house, you know, force the dismissal of a government. And you think to yourself, well, hang on a minute, there's only two governments ever been dismissed in Australia, you're probably thinking, Jack Lang in New South Wales and Gough Whitlam, 1975, both Labor. But actually there were dismissals of governments in Victoria, but they were just given a different description. And so they were described as being resignations that were not voluntary. Or sometimes they were described, the person was required to resign at the request of the governor. And so there were conservative governments that were brought down by Labor governments, you know, who were blocking supply in the upper house. So this was not unprecedented stuff. It did happen, and it happened within living memory of 1975. So most of the crises in Victoria happened in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. And one of the really interesting things is you go back and you read all the documents about the Whitlam dismissal and you read the legal advices that were given. So the Solicitor General, Sir Maurice Byers, was asked to advise on Ellicott's opinion, where Ellicott had argued that the Governor General was obliged to dismiss in these circumstances. And when you read Sir Maurice's opinion, he's not referring to any of those examples that occurred at the state level. And I think one of the reasons is that they hadn't been written about in books. We just forget the stuff, particularly at the state level, that has happened. It was a little cause célèbre in the newspapers for 3 or 4 days, and then we moved on, and no one was maintaining the rage, okay? And people just forgot about it. And if it wasn't in a book written down, then nobody went back and used those precedents and considered them again. And so that's one of the interesting things that actually affects the Whitlam dismissal, that when Sir Maurice Byers and other people were looking for examples, they were going back to H.V. Evatt's book, which was really old, and they missed all that much more recent history. But I do have to wonder why people just didn't have the memory from having lived through those experiences. For example, if you listen to the live reporting of the dismissal on the ABC radio, and there's a fellow who's, I think it's called, was it the Whitlam dismissal files on the internet? But he's actually, you can, there's links there and you can listen to the live ABC reporting on the day, which is just fascinating. And I was listening to it and I heard a professor of constitutional law from Victoria saying, this is utterly unprecedented. There is nothing like this has ever happened before. I'm thinking, you live in Victoria. This has happened. All these things like, you know, the Governor General asking advice from the Chief Justice. Absolutely standard practice, happened in every single constitutional controversy going all the way back to Federation at the state level, at the Commonwealth level. In 1975, everybody said, this is extraordinary. This is unprecedented. No, it wasn't. It was actually normal practice. You can't find an example of a constitutional crisis in Australia without a Chief Justice advising before 1975. There were all these precedents. So one of the reasons why it's not known is it wasn't in books. But the other one, and this comes back to the archives, is that a lot of the documents were all still secret. You know, the documents were held by archives is what happened, and they weren't released. And so this morning, I was actually here at the archives and at the National Library, and I was actually reading the correspondence where governors general were writing letters to the monarch, okay? But I was reading it from 1914 to about 1921 this morning. But a lot of this stuff just wasn't accessible to the people who were involved in later crises. So they didn't know what the precedents were. So everything seemed unprecedented at a time when you don't know what the precedents are. Mm. And so that's why, in many ways, the dismissal was very shocking. I mean, A, yeah, it hadn't happened at the Commonwealth level before, that's true. But B, the things that people were being fed by academics and by the media were often quite wrong in terms of saying, this is absolutely outrageous, nothing like this has ever happened before. We were misled and we also forgot. Oh, there's a lot of missing history there.
I wonder, Frank, if the events surrounding the dismissal weren't unprecedented, should Whitlam himself have been more aware that the Governor-General would not necessarily leave him to govern without supply, and that dismissal, his dismissal, was a genuine...
We know from the Palace letters that Whitlam did have various historical precedents in mind as he grappled with Kerr, as he grappled with the crisis. He does talk a bit about the Lang dismissal in 1932, but the one that really stands out for me in that correspondence is what I guess is often called the budget crisis or the Lloyd George crisis. This is, you know, the confrontation really between the Liberal government in Britain between 1909 and 1911 that eventually broke the power of the House of Lords. I mean, the House of Lords' capacity to block any legislation indefinitely, of course, is basically gone now, and it's really a product of that crisis. And it's quite clear that at least at some point in this crisis, Whitlam thought he was doing a Lloyd George, that this was a historic confrontation between a government and the Senate, and he was going to win and he was going to break the power of the Senate just as the power of the House of Lords had been broken by 1911. And so I think that is the historical precedent that probably means most to Whitlam. It's a reminder, I think, of how important British history was, perhaps for that generation. And, you know, I think that it may have blinded him, actually, to the dangers that he was subjecting his government to. That in fact, this is a very different situation, that the powers of the Senate were different. It's an elected house. It wasn't an appointed or a house of aristocrats and bishops and so on. The Senate is not the House of Lords. It's a different kind of house. It represents a federal dimension of the system.
Perhaps it seems unprecedented, even though I take your point that it's not, because of the very nature of that government, the bigness, the boldness. I suppose we would call it disruption today. In fact, Brendan, you write about Whitlam that he had been engaged long before 1975 in a program of informal constitutional transformation. He was seeking to do this through lawmaking rather than through referendum. And I think you mean here that he was seeking to expand and centralise more power in the federal government to get his agenda through. Can you talk about Whitlam and his informal constitutional transformation?
We're acknowledging today the proclamation of the written constitution, but sitting underneath that constitution are a whole range of assumptions that were made when it was drafted that are not written down. There's also a whole lot of political compromises that were made in the drafting that leave room for interpretation, ambiguity, and future choices. And so a lot of what counts as constitutional law is not found in the document proclaimed in 1900, but is found in other fragments of ordinary law. Judicial decisions, even ordinary statutes, unwritten conventions. Those things are capable of being changed without formally amending the text that was proclaimed in 1900. I think to really understand what was going on in the 1970s, one has to look at Whitlam's own history. What was he reacting against or responding to? The Curtin and Chifley governments had failed in a lot of respects to achieve Labor's objectives. Attempts in the 1940s to formally amend the constitution had failed at referenda. Election campaigns since the Curtin and Chifley governments had involved Labor putting forward an electoral program on the proviso that they would seek formal change through a referendum. And Whitlam, from as early as 1957, embarks on speeches and writings about how that's the wrong path for Labor to go down, and that Labor needs to look at what powers might already exist in the constitution or plausibly exist and be capable of argument and expansion. And so by the time he becomes prime minister, elected on a campaign agitating for wide-ranging reforms and centralisation of power, he is expressly saying, I am here to change the constitution, not the formal text, but the constitutional principles. And I'm going to do it by enacting laws and testing the scope of constitutional powers. Now, when someone says that's what they're going to do, there's a question, well, what is the legitimate process for doing that? If what you're doing is changing the written constitution, there's an express procedure that one has to follow, and the rules are very clear. If what one is doing is changing the informal parts of the constitution, there's an open question, how is one to do it? And Whitlam's claim was, well, I told you I was going to do it. You elected me. Here I am.
And what's wrong with that argument?
Well, if you emphasise the British aspects of of Australia's constitutional tradition, there's nothing wrong with it. It's correct. But we also have American inheritances within our constitutional system. So we have a Senate that is not the House of Lords. We have a High Court that is capable of striking down legislation. Now, the Senate, even though it's elected, in 1972, when Whitlam comes to power, it was constituted of senators who'd been elected in 1967 and 1970. So it's arguably stale, lacking in a democratic mandate. And even today, when you have simultaneous elections, there's arguments that it's malapportioned and not truly representative of the people. So there are arguments to be made about the democratic credentials of the Senate. When the Senate comes to block legislation, it did in the 1970s expressly respond to Whitlam's claims in constitutional terms. And it said, well, you are changing the constitution, and so we are going to search for ways to put a brake on that. And blocking supply is not, it's not blocking supply for the sake of having the government run out of money. It's blocking supply for the instrumental purpose of forcing an election to be called. The argument is, well, you can't just win one election and enact legislation that is not ordinary law, but in truth, constitutional law. If that's what you want to do, you need a series of elections where that program is laid out more clearly and you generate more decisive evidence of the people's support.
I mean, you're explaining the argument. Do you have a view about whether the action of the Senate in blocking Whitlam's agenda was a legitimate, it was clearly legal, but was it a legitimate course of action?
It depends what you mean by legitimate, because as a constitutional lawyer, I would say it was legal. And it was backed by a plausible basis for legitimacy. So the Senate's claim was, we speak for the people. The House of Representatives doesn't have an exclusive claim to speak for the people. And it's got a basis in the American-inflected aspects of our Constitution, but it is wrong if you were to take the British-inflected effects of the Constitution, and Whitlam did, and said, no, I control the House, I've won the election, I have a mandate, you can't do it.
It's 50 years since one of the most tumultuous events in Australian political history, the late Prime Minister Gough Whitlam's dismissal from office. Barrister Brendan Lim, legal scholar Anne Toomey, historian Frank Bongiorno are joining journalist and my former ABC colleague, of course, Paul Barclay. Today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, we're coming to you from the National Archives of Australia, and I'm Natasha Mitchell. So how well equipped are we today to deal with a political crisis like that car crash of 1975? And what does it say about the relative powers of the then Queen, now King, the Governor-General and the Prime Minister in our country?
Can I, Anne, ask you a basic constitutional law question here? The 75, as we know, occurs because the Senate is in deadlock. There's a standoff between the major parties. Supply is blocked. That deadlock is broken by the government being dismissed, Parliament being resolved and going to a new election. We know all of that. What does the Constitution, though, actually say about what the Governor-General's powers are to sack a Prime Minister or a government, the circumstances in which he or she can do that, when he or she can ignore the Prime Minister's advice, appoint a caretaker Prime Minister and approve a new election? Does any of that sit within the black letter constitution?
No. That's a short answer. Look, there are bits in the constitution. So obviously there's a power to appoint ministers, there's a power to appoint the person who effectively is the Prime Minister who's commissioned to form the government. That power to appoint has always been regarded as a reserve power, which means it's a power that's exercised not on ministerial advice, but as a matter of discretion. But it's the conventions that live under it that are important. So we have a constitution that's based on a number of principles. One of them is responsible government. And so a key principle of responsible government is that the Governor-General appoints the person who is most likely to command the confidence of the lower house, and that's the person who's appointed as Prime Minister. Okay, so that's a basic principle and a convention. There's a whole lot of other principles and conventions that are sloshing around in there as well, but the power to appoint ministers in Section 64 and 65 of the Constitution also involves a power to not appoint them or to get rid of them. So technically, yes, there is a power in there. And there's also the power to hold the double dissolution election. So that's a much more prescriptive one. So Section 57 does say you've got to have the triggers and they have to have complied with all of these certain circumstances. But when it comes to it, the Governor General, when exercising the power to grant a double dissolution election, and I was just reading this in both the archives and the National Library, in 1914, when the first double dissolution was held, again, the Governor General took the view that the ultimate decision as to whether or not to allow it was a discretionary one. It was not one where they were bound to act on the advice of ministers. And indeed, the Chief Justice, Sir Samuel Griffith, advised in relation to that as well. You've got a whole lot of moving parts here. To make the Constitution work, you don't, as Brendan said, it's not just the words on the page. The words on the page are predicated upon a whole lot of principles. So they involve not only responsible government, but the democratic principles and representative government, the federalism principles about the relationship between the Commonwealth and the states and the Senate as a representative of the various houses. So there's a lot going on there. But just before you ask your next question, there's one other thing I just wanted to add to what Brendan was saying about the business about there's the British side and there's the American side of it. One other quite fascinating thing about the Whitlam government was they did clash with the British because Whitlam, for example, wanted to get rid of Privy Council appeals, right? And so he thought, as Brendan said, there are other ways to do this rather than a referendum. So idea number one was to say to the British, well, appoint every single High Court judge as a Privy Councillor, as a Privy Council member of the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, and then ensure that all appeals to the Privy Council are heard by those High Court judges. So effectively, the Privy Council is the High Court. The interesting thing here is that the British said, no, because that goes against the principle of your constitution in section 128, which is if you want to amend the constitution, you need a referendum. And they said, if you want to do this stuff, you've got to have a referendum. So they said, no, not doing that. And so then Whitlam says, okay, well, let's have a treaty with the United Kingdom about the Privy Council and we'll use the external affairs power to do that and make legislation about it. And the British said, no, if you want to amend your constitution, you have to comply with section 128 of the constitution. So what's really interesting is that a country which doesn't have that kind of, it doesn't have an entrenched constitution, it doesn't have a history of referendums, the courts can't knock down legislation there, all of that. But you get your Lord Chancellor and whatever coming to Whitlam and saying, you want to change your constitution, you've got to follow your own requirements and have a referendum, which I think is quite surprising, really.
So Frank, you and I aren't constitutional lawyers, so we can talk about this. Don't you think the constitution should more clearly spell this stuff out? I mean, tradition, convention, the vibe. I mean, we have a situation where it is totally conceivable that at some point in the future, the Senate could block supply and bring the functioning of a democratically elected government, which is formed in the lower house. Yet we have nothing in our constitution to tell us if that happens, what we should do about it. Should this stuff be written down? Or should we just leave it up to how things have been done in the past and some sense of what the proper course of action is?
Well, I suppose in a way the democracy's kind of made that decision, hasn't it? I mean, it's left that capacity there. There would presumably be ways in which the power of the Senate could be curbed in the way that, I guess, state legislative council's powers have been curbed. I mean, when the Brax government did legislative council reform about, 20-odd years ago, a bit over 20 years ago, it took away the power to block supply. So the kinds of constitutional crises Anne, you were talking about in Victoria back in the 30s, 40s, yep, couldn't happen now.
Would that be a good idea at the federal level, in your view?
I don't think the Senate should be allowed to block supply, no. But, you know, I don't really, I mean, we all know how difficult constitutional reform is in this country. You know, there are a number of other aspects of the Constitution that I think need revision, like, you know, Section 44. But it's not going to happen. Look, and I suppose I'm broadly speaking more comfortable with, you know, the kind of system Brendan described earlier. I mean, the reality is that the principles of responsible government that in this country go back to the 1850s, and which really, I suppose, came out of Canadian experience, didn't they, in the 1840s, you know, they give life to our system. They're fundamentally important to our system. And when they're breached, it's deeply problematic. I mean, when Scott Morrison took his five secret ministries, I mean, the week that happened, I was teaching, you know, the 1850s in my class at university, and, you know, I put aside the notes and I just said to the students, well, what was wrong with that? What was wrong with what's happened here? And it was a great way of testing students' understanding of the way that, you know, the importance of convention, the importance of what I think Peter Hennessy calls the good chaps aspect of British-style constitutions, which, and he brought that up, I think, a few years back in the context of Boris Johnson's breaches of convention. He said, look, you know, the whole system operates on a kind of good chaps set of principles. That is that, you know, there are good chaps there who basically play by the rules. And if they're not prepared to play by the rules, well, yeah, it can be quite catastrophic. And in a sense, it was the good chap system that broke down in 1975, I think.
And increasingly we are seeing around the world a rise of populist leaders, in some cases in democracies, where those leaders are not prepared to play by the rules, are not prepared to follow constitutional traditions. How worried should we be about that potentially in a country like Australia, where, as we've just discussed, so much of the functioning of government is extra-constitutional, is determined by convention and tradition? Anne, you want to have a go at that?
Yeah, look, this worries me quite a lot at the moment. So I'm completely conflicted on this, because on the one hand, Post-1975, when a lot of the countries in the Pacific region got independence and got their own constitutions, they reacted against what happened with the Whitlam government and the dismissal of its dismissal. And so they created very prescriptive constitutions which said, you know, if this happens, this happens, this happens, and they tried to get rid of all flexibility and convention and whatever. And that turned out to be not very good, because when those constitutions faced a crisis, and it was one that hadn't been anticipated, they didn't have the flexibility to be able to manage it. So from all the study I've done of constitutions, I'm actually, my preference is for ones that have at least a degree of flexibility built in, because very prescriptive constitutions are brittle and they break under pressure. So it doesn't have to be complete flexibility. Some of the stuff you do need to probably put in writing. And so, for example, fixing up the rules after the secret ministry crisis, which was done, was important. Okay, so there's stuff that we can fix and make a bit more prescriptive, but having some flexibility in there is important. But in more recent times, I have become very worried about populist governments that take the view that once they are elected, that election mandate gives them the power to do whatever they want, and that they will not be restricted by courts and the rule of law. They will not be restricted by parliaments, that they can do what they like because they had the mandate of being elected. Now, I'm seeing that happen more and more in other countries around the world, and it frightens me. To not give you the absolute details, but I was asked the other day to give some advice to a government about how to deal with a particular issue, and we were looking at how to fix it, and I said, well, this is all fine, we should do this, but the one thing we need to do is put in more guardrails to stop this particular power that we were going to give people from being abused into the future, because I am concerned about what is going on and this disrespect for the rule of law and a separation of powers, which is becoming more obvious around the world. And so, yes, our system, because it is based so much on good chaps and convention, is vulnerable. So on the one hand, I want to keep a degree of flexibility to make things work. But on the other hand, I really want to make sure that there are sufficient guardrails to prevent that kind of abuse of power.
Yes, and the era that we're in, Brendan, too, is characterised by disengagement, institutional distrust. Yeah, do you agree with Anne that we need to perhaps think about the potential issues with our convention and tradition-based constitution?
It's certainly of concern to me as well. I think the events of 1975 and other events really show, though, that we do have in Australia multiple institutions that would be capable of acting as a brake on the rise of populism in any one institution. And that the problem arises if all the institutions get overtaken at the same time or with rapid speed, like we might see in some other parts of the world at the moment. The institutional dysfunctions of 1975 actually illustrate a potential strength as well, that there are pathways to slow things down or offer resistance, but again, entirely dependent on the people occupying those offices observing appropriate restraint and respect for constitutional propriety, which is something other than constitutional law.
It's kind of interesting, though, isn't it, that, you know, 50 years on, we can look at the role the Senate's played across that half century, so that the problem chamber, if you like, of 1975. And I would have thought that it's actually done marvels for democratic accountability in this country. I mean, through the Senate estimates process, through the fact that, you know, you normally have some kind of balance of power situation there that constrains hasty governments. I mean, on the whole, I think, you know, it's not a product perhaps of 1975, although I think it probably contributed, but, you know, you could argue that in fact we have a stronger democratic system in 2025, partly as a result of the way that the Senate has developed. I mean, as because of its electoral system since 1948, 49, but also the development of the committee system and particularly, you know, things like that Senate estimates process. So, you know, I think there's a really positive story to be told about that.
So, Frank, earlier on, I think you both, yourself and Anne, referred to the Palace Letters. Now, the National Archives of Australia, where we are tonight, is the repository of the Australian Constitution and other important archival documents, including the Palace Letters, the letters between the Queen through her private secretary, Martin Charteris, the Governor-General, John Kerr, around the time of the crisis. But the archives were also an active participant in opposing the public release of these letters, requested by Whitlam biographer and historian Jenny Hocking. Actually, Anne was saying that she'd put in a request to see them some years before that too. Now, the archives lost that battle to keep the letters under embargo. They've been released. What was all this about in a nutshell? Can you summarise this matter for us?
It was a pretty complicated matter. Jenny Hocking litigated it, took the archives to court, and it went through two federal court cases, actually, and then eventually the High Court, and she won the eventual case, 6-1, I think, was the result. My understanding is that the archives maintained on its legal advice that correspondence between a Governor-General and the palace, between the Governor-General and the monarch of the day, were actually personal. That is, that they were not Commonwealth records within the meaning of the Archives Act of 1983. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but to my common sense at the time and now, that doesn't make a great deal of sense. I mean, as far as I know, John Kerr and Martin Charteris, or John Kerr and the Queen, were unlikely to be undertaking a correspondence separate from their public roles. But anyway, this was obviously the legal advice that the archives had. They fought the case. It was very expensive for the archives, of course. I mean, several million dollars involved. But Jenny Hocking eventually won that case. We got to see those records. They were a disappointment for some people who thought that they were, thought there'd be a letter in there that said, you know, "Dear Liz, I'm going to do it today," signed John. Personally, I didn't expect that was going to happen. But, I mean, in fact, they are incredibly rich, an incredibly rich set of sources, and can be read and used for a whole range of different things. They've got nothing to do with the dismissal. I mean, I'm fascinated by them as a historian of monarchy, as someone who's interested in the place of the monarchy, the shifting place of the monarchy in Australian history. I have a colleague, for instance, who used them for the honours system, because there's all sorts of material in there on the development of the Australian honours system. They're incredibly rich. They're rich rich in personal sketches and details, so that they are an absolutely marvellous source. They're voluminous too. I mean, they show the extent to which Kerr was looking to the palace to fortify himself in this emerging crisis. I mean, you go to... We have other palace letters now, of course, for other governors general, and they're much less voluminous than the mere, what is it, 3 years or whatever it was of the Kerr governor generalship.
I was just reading today the ones of Lord Nova.
Was there for a long time. Yeah, yeah.
There's an enormous amount.
True, true.
So it is true that they lessened off after Kerr, but there were a lot of the early ones, there were a hell of a lot. And they are magnificent. Yeah. I was reading the most astonishing stuff today. And you can do it. Those ones are down at the National Library. But, you know, honestly, if you want to read just a snapshot of what the world was like in Australia for, you know, with Novar, it was like every 2 months or whatever he'd send this letter. Mm. And it is astonishing. I was reading, you know, World War One, and, you know, then you get Gallipoli and you get all this sort of, you know, the real emotion of the time of it. Really vivid. Lots of personality and quite a bit of bitchy comments too.
Oh, yes,
there's a lot of that in there.
He had a very low opinion of most Australians, was my general impression.
But just getting back to the letters between the government and the Queen, I suppose the question many people wanted to know, did the palace letters reveal whether Kerr informed the Queen of his intention to sack Whitlam? And more broadly, do the letters contain any startling revelations? Do they shed any new light on this dismissal period? Yeah, for you.
Yeah. First of all, no, they didn't say that I was going to do it. obviously, and as Kerr himself said frequently, he didn't want to drag the Queen into the crisis, so he wasn't going to tip her off in advance, was he? There was certainly a lot of discussion about, you know, what's interesting is that Kerr, when the issue of dismissal first comes up in the letters, it is constantly in the context of him providing news clippings where the media is discussing dismissal. So the first comments about dismissal are from the media saying, well, you know, in these circumstances, supplies block, Governor General's going to have to dismiss, right? So it does come up and it's mentioned in hypotheticals along the way, but he's never asking advice about it. And every time the palace responds, they sort of say, well, you know, reserve powers shouldn't be exercised except in extremis, you know, calm down, you know, don't do anything. Because it wasn't ever in the interests of the palace for the Whitlam government to be dismissed, because all it was going to do is cause drama and potentially a republic in Australia. So it was completely contrary to the monarch's interests. And if they had been asked, A, they probably would have said, we can't comment and we won't interfere. But if they had a choice, they did not want this to happen.
Considering the political, the constitutional earthquake that was the dismissal of Prime Minister Gough Whitlam 50 years ago this year, and whether our constitution is fit for purpose today. Legal scholar Anne Toomey, barrister Brendan Lim and historian Frank Bongiorno with host, longtime former ABC journalist Paul Barclay here on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. This is a 2025 Constitution Day forum that was held at the National Archives of Australia in the nation's capital. When the palace letters, the correspondence between Governor-General John Kerr and the Queen on this political crisis were opened up, what did they reveal?
The most interesting thing I found was actually the bit about Gough ringing the palace.
Yes, because at 4:15 in the morning.
Exactly, because if you read what Gough said in his, I think it was the truth of the matter or whatever, he denies that. He says that it was only at the end of the day, after everything was done, that he rang his good friend Martin Charteris in order to sort of, you know, commiserate over what happened. And that's just completely false. So we know that he lied about that now. And so we know that the phone call came through at 4:15, and I've traced back the times and I know exactly when he made his phone call. He made his phone call immediately after the vote in the House of Representatives, which was a vote of no confidence in Fraser. So as soon as he got the House of Representatives to vote no confidence in Fraser, he went straight to the palace in order to get reinstated. And what is said in the palace letters, and I don't know how true this is, but they said that he didn't ask for the Queen to do it, but what he wanted was the palace to tell Kerr to do it. So for all the denial of running off to the Queen, he did it. And what's even more interesting is about 15 minutes later, after he'd done that, maybe it's half an hour later, but he gets interviewed by the media. And that's when I was listening to the live coverage to find out precisely when that interview happened. And he gets interviewed and he gets asked, have you contacted the Queen? And he says, no. He said, I wasn't given the opportunity to do so. And that's immediately after he's contacted the palace. For me, that was the revelation. And it's sort of quite interesting because a lot of the narrative of the Whitlam government was about trying to break the colonial links. So there was all the stuff about breaking off the links with the Privy Council. There was stuff about the channel of communication to the monarch and all the rest of it. And so his entire government had been about ending these colonial links and being independent. But the very first thing he does when he's dismissed and he gets that vote by the House of Representatives, he goes straight off to the palace to get the palace to overturn it. And I think that tells you a lot about the psychology at the time, that in the end, we weren't really independent. We still had to race off to England to get someone to resolve these things for us, which I found quite shocking. I mean, but there you go.
Brendan, one of the things about the dismissal at the time was because it embroiled the palace and embroiled the Queen and the Governor General, it did, I suppose, fuel in many Australians the desire for us to become a republic. And from 75 onwards, the republican movement slowly grew in strength until 1999. You addressed this to some extent in your book, when we did have a vote on whether Australia would become a republic, and it all got tied up in terms of the majority of Australians, I think we agree at the time, did want Australia to become a republic but couldn't decide on the mechanism by which we should do that. I was just thinking, if you'd asked this question back in 1999, what was the legacy of 1975, you might have said the push for Australia to become a republic, but you probably wouldn't say that today, would you?
Probably not today. The interesting thing about the Republican movement is that in the wake of the dismissal, there was a lot of interest in, well, what should the powers of a head of state be? Mm. There was a lot of consideration of the question we've canvassed before, should these powers be codified in some way? And if you're going down the track of proposing a constitutional amendment to become a republic and you need to create a different office of head of state, the question arises, well, do you write down the powers of that office? What should they be? Is the president of the new Australian Republic just the Governor-General with a new name? Yep. Or is it someone with more significant powers? Are they appointed by the parliament or are they elected by the people and therefore have their own democratic mandate, their own ability to exercise real power? And those are the questions that really split the different camps in the 1999 referendum.
And they're complex questions, aren't they?
Very complex. And no right answer. But I think for a Republican movement to succeed, they demand an answer. Mm. Because to prosecute the case for republicanism just on grounds of national identity or we're Australian and not British, you will always just mask that much more fundamental disagreement in Australia about whether the head of state should be ceremonial or substantive.
Frank, another one of the issues, I was kind of wondering whether I should bring this up, but I will. There are a lot of conspiracy theories around the sacking of the Whitlam government. One of them was actually that the palace wanted Whitlam gone. And there were some people who thought the palace letters may have uncovered some proof of that, which, spoiler alert, they didn't. But I suppose the most common conspiracy theory really was that the CIA was out to get Whitlam.
Yeah.
Anything in that one? Yeah.
Well, there's certainly something in it to the extent that it exercised an extraordinary influence on the Australian left, I think in the later 70s and into the 80s. So to that extent, it's one of those things that's a kind of the myth takes on a life of its own and a force of its own. Now, I'm no expert on this, but one of the things that was happening in October, November 1975 was a kind of a crisis, a parallel crisis, if you like, involving the government's relationship with the intelligence services in Australia. So I think the government removed the head of both ASIO and ASIS in that period, if I remember rightly. There's, I think, it's a period when it's, I think, the renewal of one of the key American bases, Pine Gap possibly, yep. was up for, you know, sort of at that very moment. And I think that has fueled that kind of conspiracy theory because they're both kind of occurring at the same time. Are they linked? You know, Kerr, you know, did he have links to these to the CIA? Was he acting at their, you know, sort of behest or whatever? As far as I'm aware, there's no serious historical research that's been able to connect them. I think the last sort of major work I saw on this was probably in the official ASIO histories. You might say, oh, well, what would you expect to find in the official? But in fact, these were written by very reputable historians who did very good research. And they did test this and you know, explore the fact that they are occurring at the same time, these two sets of crises, but could not establish a connection between the two. And I think I remain convinced by that.
A final question, Anne. I mean, what are the lessons of 75 for today, all of the circumstances that led to the constitutional crises of 1975 still exist today. It could conceivably happen. What have we learnt from 1975 and what are the chances of something similar happening at a federal level again?
Well, until the last couple of years and what's been happening in some other parts of the world, I would have said that the lesson from 1975 was really one of moderation. So the crisis that occurred in 1975 led people to say, well, actually, we shouldn't push the envelope to the edge. Maybe we should be more moderate and a bit more respectful because that way you earn greater legitimacy. I mean, one of the problems with 1975 for both Kerr and Fraser was it really did undermine their future ability to operate. It was always a shadow over the Fraser government. If Fraser had just waited a little longer and come to office without that kind of shadow living over him, it probably would have aided his government significantly. And so, you know, post 1975, you had parties in the Senate saying, well, we're never going to block supply again, and they were party policies. And so what came out of 1975 was the importance of moderation and respect and not taking things to extremes. And I think that was a good outcome from 1975. But as I said a bit earlier, I've become, you know, because of recent happenings in other places, I have become more concerned in recent years that maybe our, again, it's a memory thing, isn't it? The people who remember the trauma of 1975 and the need to be moderate are sort of beginning to die out, and maybe the new people coming up just don't have that kind of memory and that experience that's guiding them and do start to take the view of, hey, I've won the election, I have power, I'm going to exercise it, I don't care what anyone else says, I'm just going to go ahead and do and break through, and don't see the virtues in moderation.
Well, what a fantastic discussion it's been. This really is one of those conversations that could go on ad infinitum. We've really just scratched the surface.
And in this event from the National Archives of Australia in Canberra, marking 50 years since the Whitlam dismissal. 50 years, half a century, wild. You heard from Anne Toomey, Professor Emerita of Constitutional Law at the University of Sydney Law School. Historian Frank Bongiorno, author of Dreamers and Schemers, A Political History of Australia, who last week announced his new role as the Donald Horne Professor of History and Public Ideas and Director of a new Centre of Public Ideas at the University of Canberra. Our congratulations, Frank. And barrister Dr. Brendan Lim is author of the book Australia's Constitution After Whitlam. They were speaking with journalist and my former colleague here at ABC Radio National, Paul Barclay. And where were you in 1975? I'd love to hear from you. What enduring memories do you have of that day, that moment and its legacy? You can email me, bigideas@abc.net.au. I'm Natasha Mitchell, back next time with more big thinkers at the best live events. Catch you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.